Welcome back, and that was Sam Sparrow and Black and Gold, 12 minutes past two here on Vectus Radio. Delighted to welcome Joe Rees. I think your third interview with us. Just because, as I said earlier, there's just too much to talk about for one interview. So you're very welcome. Now, what we thought we'd do today is we've had a lot of listeners asking questions after previous interviews.
Yep.
So we thought it'd be really good to have some of those questions and see... Start with the basics, really.
Yep.
Because if you know all about dyslexia, you know these things. If you don't, you're going to ask them. So let's get straight in there. One we've been asked, what are the early signs of dyslexia in a young child? Is there something that parents should be looking out for?
So I always think that quite a big tell is when you have like an uber confident child before they start school. So you have like a toddler that's really interested in the world, is really kind of interested in how things work, potentially has got really good language, asks a million and one questions. But then when they go to school, that progress kind of isn't in line. There's like a bit of a mismatch. It just kind of isn't making sense. Like the literacy skill just doesn't seem to be transferring into academic progress. So that's kind of one sign. I guess other signs are things like once they've kind of started school, it's, you know, when they're reading, potentially a reluctance to read or having to not developing what we call a sight vocabulary. So a sight vocabulary is when we look at a word and we can recall it automatically. And dyslexic children tend to really struggle to develop that sight vocabulary. So they, you might find that they're having to sound the same word out on the same page every single time.
Yeah, I'm nodding away here because this all sounds so familiar.
And I guess with spelling, it's things like quite phonetic spelling. So, you know, making errors around vowel sounds, like not identifying all of the sounds within a word. And again, sort of spelling words differently. So there's a few things, there's lots. Yeah. But yeah, we'll scratch the surface with that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Thank you. Now, dyslexia people think about with words, but there's two, and I don't know why these words have to be such big words.
Okay.
It's always been a bit ironic to me. But dyscalculia.
Yeah.
And dysgraphia.
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
So,
and do they come together?
Dyscalculia, I learned recently. So I've been doing a lot of work with the Dyscalculia Network, who I'm just going to do a little shout out here on the 13th of November. Kat, one of the founding members, is talking at my conference. So she taught me that discount, because I used to call it dyscalculia, and it's dyscalculia, and it rhymes with Julia. So there we go, there's a way of remembering that. So dyscalculia is separated out from dyslexia, and it's to do with number and number sense and understanding the value of number. So people with dyscalculia struggle to estimate, they struggle to know the fourness of four. So you could have four out, but they would have to like literally count them. They rely really heavily on one-to-one correspondence, struggle with place value. So it tends to be just difficult with number. And if anybody wants any information on dyscalculia, the Dyscalculia Network is the best place to go for loads of free advice and support. Kat and Rob that have founded that are actually doing some pretty incredible work with the government at the moment to try and reform maths curriculum and all sorts. So
excellent.
Please do go check them out. Dysgraphia is to do with writing and spelling, and it's the one I actually know least about. And again, shout out for the conference. The conference that's happening on the Isle of Wight on November 13th, we've actually got a whole masterclass on that from Dr. Helen Ross, who's back for a second year, who's going to be talking to us about dysgraphia. But it's really to do with spelling and handwriting and how we organise our ideas and writing. I'm pretty sure that my husband is dyslexic and dysgraphic.
Okay.
Not ADHD,
so,
but yeah.
If you've got one, is it likely you've got more than one, or does it not work like that?
So with the dyses, it's the same as any other learning difference, really. They can totally co-occur, but they can also happen completely separately. And it's about kind of, and I think labelling them is important, because then we know how to support them. One of the things I would say is, you know, and why dyscalculia has traditionally been tricky to diagnose is because actually you can be dyslexic and struggle with maths because of working memory, because of processing, because of difficulties with language. Because, you know, if you've got a teacher that's just going too quickly, then that doesn't mean you've got difficulties with number. It means that you it's gone too quickly for you to secure the process. So, so it's about kind of really digging deep and kind of, I'm picking which difficulty belongs to which difference.
I think that's so true. So my youngest daughter, dyslexia, we knew from the age of about 7, 8. The dyscalculia... actually kind of emerged alongside it, and somewhere down the line we went, hang on, this is more than dyslexia. So absolutely. And I think, you know, that's the thing, as a parent you feel very guilty. It's like, I should have known this before, I should have seen it. But it's knowing what to look for.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing is if there's also something, there's a third thing. So there's the trouble with maths. Dr. Steve Gin, I think he's a doctor. Anyway, he's done loads of work for the British Dyslexia Association and the Dyscalculia Network. And he talks about how you can also have anxiety with maths, which can look like acquired dyscalculia. Because the thing with maths is it's either right or it's wrong. So in your book, you quite often have hundreds of crosses at school. And people think like they can't do maths and they kind of develop this anxiety. So it's also unpicking whether you're just anxious about doing maths or whether it's a stubborn number sense maths difficulty.
Absolutely. Lovely. Right, so let's move on now. This is one that I know is very close to Shannon's heart. So visual stress, which I had never heard of until Shannon was diagnosed with it.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of it until you diagnosed me with it.
Yes. So what is visual stress, and does everyone who has dyslexia also have visual stress?
Okay, so yellow overlays are my pet hate. And I talk a lot about this on social media. So visual stress, or sometimes it's known as mid-Erlands, or sometimes it's known as, I'm not going to pronounce it right, scopic sensitivity, is a completely separate co-occurring difficulty. And I think the more we learn about learning differences and the more research that that's happening all the time, it's we're able to kind of separate out these things from each other. So I think, again, historically, I think, you know, 20 years ago, people with dyslexia might report words moving around, or people that didn't have a dyslexia diagnosis would report words moving around, and it was assumed that that was part of dyslexia. It's actually completely different, and it's to do with the way your brain processes light. Basically, the white hits the back of your brain, kind of causes a sensory difficulty, which makes everything look like it's
moving.
So we're
talking about if you've got black text on a white background, then you might not be able to read that very well, which is...
It hurts your head.
Shannon's experience.
But it's not necessarily just things moving. So it can be that, like, the white collects to create rivers on a page, or it can be that it just looks blurry. What I would say is if you suspect visual stress, it's actually really important that you go to an optician, first of all, because these symptoms can be... these symptoms can be symptoms of medical things which are quite sinister. So we need to go to an optician first of all to get all of that ruled out. Once we know our eye health is fine, there's two different routes you can go down. So you can go down the optician's route. You can find a colorimetrist that will find out what overlay you need, and we'll make what we call the spectral filters in the block color. Or you can go down the Erlen route, which is slightly different, copyrighted American, a bit controversial, but again, you will get an overlay. And then the filters that Erlen diagnosticians create are more like sunglasses. So they filter out the colors that bother you, as opposed to being a block color,
which is often why when you see actors wearing what look like colored sunglasses,
it's so they can read.
Johnny Depp, classic. Bono from U2.
I was just about to say Bono's the other one.
And actually everyone thinks they're just being too cool for school, but it's actually helping them read, isn't it?
So quite but amazing. Why yellow overlays drive me bonkers is, and I don't know if this is a historical thing, but it just seems to be the only colour that schools ever have.
I can't read from a yellow overlay.
And it will be like, kids, they'll do a dyslexic screen, and then a really well-meaning member of staff, and it is done in a really well-meaning way, will like give them a yellow overlay, and actually there are 10 different colours of overlay, and some colours will make it worse rather than make it better.
And some people do better with two overlays.
Grey and purple.
I mean, if I can say, so when Joe diagnosed you with visual stress, I honestly, if I hadn't seen it, I would not have believed it.
It was at the kitchen table.
So sitting with a page of words that were not connected to each other, so there was no guessing what the next word was. And black and white, you absolutely couldn't read.
Took me forever.
Some colours were making it a little bit better. But eventually a blue overlay and a lilac overlay together, which I could barely see through, and Shannon was reading fluently. And if I hadn't witnessed that, I would have just said, don't be ridiculous.
It's actually bizarrely very emotional. Like when you go from not being able to read all of a sudden, and that's not dyslexia, because an overlay doesn't suddenly teach you how to break words down, but it gets rid of that rid of that movement. It's interesting. It is controversial. You can't get it on the NHS. I get a lot of hate for it on TikTok, people telling me that Ireland doesn't exist. And if I'm really honest with you, I was on the fence for a really long time with it because I knew it was controversial. But then once you know something, you can't unknow it, can you?
No.
And I think it might have been you, Shannon, another lad I was working with at the time. And I was like, actually, I think there's more going on than just dyslexia. And I felt like kind of this ethical responsibility to kind of share what I knew. And I'm glad I did because it made a difference.
Yeah, and it means I could read.
Yeah, and she could read. It was just what the accessibility was the problem. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, let's move on from childhood. So if you've got through school and you've always thought, oh, do you know, I think I might be dyslexic. And so many people will say that, won't they? Is it something you grow out of, or is it worth actually seeking a diagnosis as an adult? What do you think?
How long have we got?
Not long.
So a diagnosis is a really personal thing. And, you know, you can be completely successful without a diagnosis. And the question I always throw back to people when they say to me, what difference is a diagnosis going to make, is, well, what difference do you want the diagnosis to make? Because actually, often people think the diagnosis is going to give them all the answers that they're looking for, and that's going to be the end of the story.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, it's the beginning of the story, and it actually creates more questions than it actually answers. And that report and that diagnosis really only has life if you give it life. And again, I think people quite often think, oh, I'm going to get a diagnosis and then I'm going to give this to my employer and my employer's going to know what to do and my employer's going to fix it for me. And actually, spoiler alert again, you probably know more about it than your employer does. Yeah. So actually, for me, my advice is, if you want to learn how you learn, if you want to make sense of your past, if you want to understand why perhaps things are taking you longer and you're slower than peers, a diagnosis can be super powerful. The other thing I would say is that people think that when they leave education, not that dyslexia is going to go away, but they're not going to see it very often, or it will only appear when the letter comes through the post or when they're doing a literacy based task. Shannon, does it go away?
It really doesn't.
it impacts everything. It spills into everything, because dyslexia is a spectrum.
Yeah.
It's not just about reading and spelling. In actual fact, reading and spelling isn't really dyslexia. Reading and spelling is the symptom of the dyslexic spectrum, you know, which is processing language, working memory, naming speed. You know, our working memory gets overloaded. You can't follow instructions. You know, it's remembering who's gone into a shop and come out with everything but the thing they actually went in for, and that's a really good example of our working memory being overloaded. Yeah. Story of my life, Shannon. Which is why I've written a list. So I think as an adult, a diagnosis can be really powerful, but you do need to be prepared to do the work, and you do need to realise it potentially will open a can of worms that will result in some emotional roller coasters potentially happening.
I think it's also very much about, are you prepared to kind of realise that there are things that may have happened in your past that would have been different if you'd been diagnosed earlier, because that could be a real roller coaster.
So,
but also, like you say, it might be the thing that unlocks the support you need in the workplace.
Yeah. So I will share something with you now that I have shared on social media, but I haven't shared face to face with anybody, particularly ironically. So I recently got a diagnosis of ADHD back in February. And what's been really interesting about that is I've ended up on medication, which was never particularly my plan. But I've also been looking really hard at how I need to change my behaviours and the things that I do which actually impact and make my ADHD worse. So I think whenever you get a diagnosis of anything, there are answers, but you also have to do the tough bit and you have to look inside yourself to see what actions you need to take in order to make the changes to make your life better as well. Nobody's going to fix it for you.
Right. It is not a crutch. It's not just suddenly going to be something that gets you off the hook for not doing things or doing them badly.
Yeah.
To say, oh, well, I can't do it because, you know, actually it might get you some additional help, but you still got to put the work in, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, the most powerful thing I think a diagnosis potentially can do is it can allow you to advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
Because there are times when we need to advocate for ourselves, because actually I can't do it that way, I'm going to do it my way, and this is the reason why I'm doing it my way. I'm not being difficult, I'm not being awkward, but I'm working with the way my brain works. So I actually think it can be really empowering in terms of self-advocacy.
Yeah, and I think helping other people understand what you need and how you need to work, absolutely. Yeah. But like you say, you've got to know that yourself first. Yeah. You've got to.
It's a journey. Use that journey word.
It's a journey, absolutely. Now, the journey for you, this conference coming up. Yeah. So, selling out? Can people come to it? How's it working?
Anybody can come to it. So you can purchase tickets through our website. It's £125 a delegate. Mm-hmm. It's going to be incredible. Last year was amazing and it did sell out. If I'm honest, we did early birds and then we haven't really pushed it since because there have been so many other things happening. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be amazing. We've got a lady called Georgina Durrant, who is a leading Senko, author of not one, two, three, four, but five books on Send. She is joining us virtually to set the whole day up with a very can-do attitude, kind of attitude and approach. The subtitle of the conference is So What Now? So the feedback last year from educators was that, you know, we've got the diagnosis, but what next? So Georgina's going to talk about kind of SEN strategy for 45 minutes. Then we've got Fintan O'Regan coming to talk to us about practical ADHD strategies. We have got Kat Edel from the Discount Culia Network coming to talk to us about really practical hands-on math strategies. She's doing a big practical workshop in the afternoon. Dr. Helen Ross is back for a second year talking about dysgraphia, as I mentioned earlier. And then there'll be roundtable discussions. And then my favourite part of the day, which is the bit at the end of the day where all of the experts sit on a panel and the delegates get to grill us.
And so who's it aimed at? I mean, would it be relevant to a parent to come along?
Yeah, so we've got, so last year we had five or six parents come along, and three of those parents are back for a second year. Excellent. They've already booked, which is amazing. Yeah. I mean, I would say it is aimed at educators and parents, but you know, anybody that wants to know more about those things that that I've mentioned there is very welcome to come along. And if you've got any questions, to know whether it's relevant or not, drop me an email.
As the parent of two daughters with dyslexia, dyscalculia and all sorts of other things, now in their late teens, early 20s, the one thing I could look back and say I learned is that, yes, you have to find that partnership with the educators. You have to be the advocate for your child. Yeah. You have to speak up for them when they maybe can't. You sometimes have to push to get the support they need. But actually, the more you know, the better you'll do that.
Absolutely.
So I would absolutely urge people to, they can see you through lots of social media.
Everywhere on social media, at Dyslexic Life with Jo Rees.
Yes. Something like the conference. Is any of that going to be put up afterwards on social media?
So delegates will have access to it afterwards. It was recorded last year. But the other thing I'm doing at the moment, which if you go to all of my social media, is I'm writing another book, Nick.
I saw
that. And this book is all about exactly what you've just said there, parent advocacy, because I feel like I've done a really good job of navigating the system for my children because I've understood it because I was a teacher and an assessor. So I'm currently writing a book. The other thing I've been doing is I'm about to launch a YouTube series called Rees Frame, Life Through the Neurodivergent Lens, which is going to be a panel show which is on once a month where we have a topic and we discuss stuff. And then I've got an amazing course for parents called, well, for children, for parents to purchase, called the Confidence Blueprint, where different thinking is met with unstoppable confidence. And that's for those kids that just lack so much confidence. School has broken them and they're not broken, but we're going to show them that they're not broken through the Confidence
and
Blueprint.
And I think it's all right to say as well that sometimes it breaks the parents.
Yes, it does.
You know, children with any of these challenges can in themselves be quite hard work, let's be honest. And so for parents, it, you know, if you don't know what you're dealing with and you don't know what to look for, the help to get, it can be really hard work. And you know what, it's okay to say that. And you've got to look after yourself first as a parent, because that's how you serve your child best.
And you know, often parents of neurodivergent kids are neurodivergent themselves. You know, it's, so you're dealing with two lots of neurodivergence. You know, it's not, it's tricky to navigate. But just going back to what you, looping back around to what you said a minute ago, because I think it's really important. I think teachers get a really rough deal. They are on the front line, as are Senkos. And unless you've been a teacher or a Senko, you are not in a position to judge. Like, they have a super tricky job. So actually, you're absolutely right. It's about working with them and building that relationship. You know, that's really, really important. And hopefully, that's what the book's going to do, and that's what the Rees Frame's going to do, is kind of support parents in
so do
nurturing.
That learning together. together.
Yeah.
Engage with your school, your teachers. Maybe you both come to the conference and take it forward.
We did have that last year. Brilliant. We had a Senko, a support assistant, a one-to-one and a parent all from the same school.
Fabulous.
How cool was that?
Yeah, really, really good.